previously.
We'd never be able to get away with saying we operated on you, but we're not going to tell you what we found,
you know,
or what we did.
Not only could we not do it, I don't think I would be able to do it from an ethical standpoint. But the study gave us great results.
It certainly did. And you know, this is just a little bit of an editorial. That is socialized medicine. That is Obamacare.
That is, well, for sure.
This is Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn, and this is Beyond the Birds and the Bees. We have this weekly radio talk show at Talk Radio 1370, and you can find it on the internet at talk1370.com. And also, if anybody is interested in asking a question, please don't hesitate to join us at 390-1370. Is Dr. Silverberg on the line?
Yep.
Oh, Dr. Kalen Silverberg is joining us. He is in the office and was delayed a little bit in the office because of patients. And, you know, that's just what happens in our practice. I mean, women ovulate on weekends, and we have to be there, right?
That's exactly right. We got to do what we got to do when we got to do it, and we have very little say in what happens. So, unfortunately, I appreciate you guys humoring me and letting me join you. This time it's not from California. This time it's from Austin. Yeah. But anyway, I'm just stuck in the office, so anyway, I'm just going to talk to you guys and then in breaks go finish taking care of stuff in the office.
Well, maybe if someone calls in and tells us how to keep women from ovulating on the weekend, Dr. Silverberg be able to make it here.
Well, we could do that with birth control pills, but I don't think that's the goal. I don't think that's what patients want.
Dr. Silverberg, we do fertility, not contraception.
That's correct. That's absolutely right.
Well, we are physicians. We're two of five physicians at the Texas Fertility Center. We have a great website, txfertility.com. You just need to go there. There's a lot of information. Our goal is to provide you with information today, but also that's a great resource.
Yeah, it's a fantastic website. It's what we call an authority site. So you know how most websites are 6 or 7 or maybe 8 pages long. Ours is over 120 pages. It has unbelievable resources. We've got incredible links to other resources, but we've got video. We have all kinds of interactive features. We have a laboratory tour. We've got pictures of some of the cute little babies that we've all been involved in helping to deliver and produce. So anyway, I would really encourage everybody to check that out. And they can also get to us through the office. And I don't know if you mentioned the phone number, but it's 451-0149. But the most important phone number today is 390-1370, because we would love to take calls. And Thomas, I know this week we had a meeting and we talked about adding some new features to the show. You want to talk about those a little bit?
Yeah, let me start out with that. What we're going to do is involve some patients who have experienced difficulty in conceiving. I think even though we feel we're really well educated about this, we've spent our whole life working in this area, no one knows what it's really like until you walk in their shoes. And if we can have them share their experience, I think it will add a lot to the show. Don't you agree, Kalen?
Oh, yeah. I think it's going to be a terrific feature. You know, we've had a lot of patients who've listened to the radio show, and they've asked us, you know, how they can help and how they can get involved, because a lot of patients have taken different journeys to get to the same endpoint. And the bottom line is that some people try on their own. They may try on their own for a year. They may try on their own for 2 or 3 years. Some patients go to see their primary care doctors, and they try and get some help there. And eventually they either get discouraged or they may get referred on to their OB-GYN. Some patients go to their OB-GYNs. In fact, a lot of patients actually start off with their OB-GYN, which is a terrific place to start. You know, we work really closely with all of the different OB-GYN groups in town, and we've got a great relationship with all of those practices. And the way we kind of describe fertility treatment to our patients is it's kind of like a relay race. So we want you to go to the OB-GYN if you want to and start off there. That's fine. They will do a basic evaluation on you, and they'll carry that baton as far around the track as they're comfortable carrying it. So if you've got some easy things to fix, you know, they want to tweak some hormone levels, they want to go ahead and try you on some fertility pills, that's great. And they'll take you around the track as far as they're comfortable taking you. And then once they've reached a point where they're no longer comfortable, they hand that baton over to us.
I think that is just great. The partnership has been very good. I think we have a really great relationship with almost all the OB-GYNs in town, and I think they appreciate what we can do for their patients.
Yeah, and plus I think that they like the fact that they feel like they're involved in the treatment. They send the patients over to us. They usually send the records over within a week or two. We see the patients. We send them a letter to tell them exactly what's going on and what we're planning on doing with the patients. And then we work with the patients. We help them conceive. And then we send them right back to the OB-GYNs because, as all the OB-GYNs in town know, we don't deliver babies. We don't do hysterectomies. In fact, if we can get away with it, we don't even do pap smears in the office.
Yeah, that's really for sure. We just want to focus on what we're doing, which is helping patients conceive. And, you know, there's a couple other little areas that we work in as well, and that is we'll see couples occasionally that really don't have problems conceiving but have learned that they may have a genetic illness or something of that sort, and we can evaluate embryos to determine which embryos are free of disease. So there's a lot of other things that are available there.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, we pride ourselves in doing fertility all the way from A to Z. And so we do evaluations. We also take care of patients with recurrent miscarriage. We also take care of patients who really just need surgical help. So, for example, patients who have bad endometriosis, their OB-GYN may not be comfortable taking care of it. Patients who have fibroid tumors of the uterus that are really adversely affecting their chance for pregnancy, and they want to maintain their fertility. So any of those problems, we're happy to see those patients as well. And, again, we work really closely with the OB-GYNs in town. And, in fact, I know you talked about the fact that we're going to have some of the some of our patients on to talk about their stories, but also in the next few weeks, we're going to start bringing guests on the show. So we're going to have some people who are in the mental health field who work with us very closely. We're going to have at least one acupuncture specialist who's going to come on and talk with us. We're going to talk to some of the urologists in town who work with guys with male fertility. And we're also going to bring on some of our referral partners for the OB-GYN, from the OB-GYN community, to talk about how we work together and to talk about issues that they think are important for our patients and for our listeners to understand.
I think this will be very, very helpful. And particularly as we work a lot with sperm, but we don't do that much with the men. We depend on the urologist to make sure exams are normal, evaluate the men, and then whatever sperm the guy makes, it's our job to make it work. So there's another partnership there that's really, really important with all of the urologists in town.
Yeah. Yeah, we work very closely with them as well. And I think that our listeners are really going to be interested in what they have to say. And there may be some surprising things as well because, you know, there's so many myths about what goes on with male infertility. You know, should you wear boxer shorts? Should you wear briefs? How much can you cycle? You know, should you cycle in the heat? Should you start to work out inside? You know, everything. In fact, I remember one of the first shows that we did, some patient called in about seat warmers in their cars, you know, about affecting sperm counts. So there's really a lot of issues, and we know that about half of the couples who come in to see us are really affected with male factor. And so it's very, very important that we go ahead and try and take care of those issues as well. And we don't want people to look at us just as female fertility specialists because we really treat the couple.
I think that's real important. You know, I do remember that question that we had about seat warmers, and I'm going, here it is in June. Who was thinking about seat warmers? And for God's sake, it's Austin. How often do you really have to use those? So that just tells you how patients are really trying to figure out on their own what's going on. Why is this not happening? Why are we not getting pregnant? And you know what I tell patients? It's not about sex. It's more about how things are not getting together. In fact, one of the questions that we received was really about positions for intercourse. Well, when you have a question like that, you have to realize there's probably no such thing as the wrong position. But I think what this patient was getting at is that she had been told by her gynecologist that her uterus was tilted, and then a radiologist told her when they did the HSG, the x-ray of the uterus and tubes, that because the uterus was tilted, that they should try a different position for intercourse.
Sure, and we see this all the time. I mean, you know, patients are very concerned. They get on the Internet. You know, kind of the joke in the office is, thank God for the Internet, because otherwise we'd be done around 2:30 every day and we'd have to go home. But, you know, patients see these things on the Internet that are written about different sexual positions and how that impacts things. And the logic behind it and the truth behind it is the position of the cervix. So, for example, if a woman's uterus is tilted forward, and we know that 75% of women have a uterus that's either straight or tilted forward, but if the uterus is tilted forward or straight, the cervix tends to point down. And so then, in that case, when sperm are deposited in the back part of the vagina, in other words, just the missionary position for intercourse or the man on top, so to speak, that's really probably the best position to get sperm towards the cervix in that direction. However, if the cervix, or if the uterus rather, is tilted backwards, and again that happens probably in about 1 out of 4 women, then the cervix frequently points anterior, points towards the bladder or towards the patient's abdomen. And in that case, if she's on her stomach, then the cervix is pointing towards the lower part of the vagina in that case. And so in that case, sometimes if she has intercourse with her on her stomach or with her prone, then it's a lot easier for the sperm to get to the cervical mucus, and they latch onto that cervical mucus, and that's how they get up inside the uterus.
Yes, I think a lot has been written about this. Probably it's going to be more about the testing and what we determine is abnormal than and actually this. Because you know what? I will tell patients, if we told you about some position, you probably have tried it, and I don't really want to hear about it, but you probably tried that anyway.
Right. Yeah, we don't want to get too involved. I mean, we're involved enough in what goes on, and, you know, some of the detail is a little more detail than we really need.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. There was another question that dealt actually with IVF, but it was kind of a more of a focus question, and it had to do with when are the sperm and eggs put together. But the way it was asked was kind of interesting because this person asked, whenever you take the sperm and the egg, and I'm going, we're not taking the sperm. You may do that. We're not going to take the sperm. That's not
right.
The doctor's job.
That's exactly right.
But basically, I think what she really was getting at is this on the same day? Well, it is on the same day, and that's true for insemination. Intrauterine insemination is on the day of ovulation. That's the most important part.
Yep. That's correct. Well, so tell me, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, you know what? I was going to mention that the promo for this was about the ENDOCAN study, which is Endometriosis Canadian Study, and that was at the end of the last session last week as we were talking about laparoscopy and talked about diagnostic and treatment, but we were spending most of our time on tubal disease, adhesions, and did not get into endometriosis except for the comment at the end about the ENDOCAN study. And, you know, it was such a landmark study.
Right.
We talked about how we could never do that legally or ethically in the States, but it was such a landmark study. I think it's worth repeating again today.
Great.
Because, Kaylin, don't you think that before the study, we sort of felt that maybe mild or minimal endometriosis was insignificant?
Oh, sure. I remember when I was in residency, I mean, you know, there was this debate has raged back and forth and back and forth for, you know, for decades now. And so just to refresh our listeners' minds and to refresh their memories, endometriosis is normal uterine lining in an abnormal location. So the uterine lining is supposed to be inside the uterus. It's not supposed to be anywhere else. It's certainly not supposed to be outside the uterus. But we know that 95% of women, when they have periods, some of that fluid will flow backwards. And those cells are alive, and they can squirt out of the end of the fallopian tubes, and they can land on the bowel or the bladder or the ovaries, and they can attach, and they grow. And, Thomas, we know that they make chemicals that can adversely affect all kinds of problems with fertility, right?
Absolutely. They can interfere with tubal function, and some of the studies have shown that the fluid around the tubes and ovaries are hostile to sperm and almost like an immunological response. So we don't know exactly how mild endometriosis causes infertility, but we do know from that study that there's a better chance of conceiving if it's treated.
Sure. And we know that there's 4 different stages of endometriosis. So 1, 2, 3, and 4, it's minimal, mild, moderate, and severe. And the way we score disease is actually using a pretty elaborate scoring system. So it's not like, you know, you just come out of the operating room and, you know, lick your finger and hold it up into the wind and see which way it's blowing and say, well, gee, that was probably stage 3 disease. It doesn't work that way. There's a scoring system. So, you know, if you've got 1 to 5 points, it's stage 1 disease, and 6 to 15 is stage 2 disease, and on. So the theory was always that bad disease, stage 3 or stage 4 disease, clearly adversely affects infertility. And so what these investigators tried to do was they said, well, you know, what about stage 1 or stage 2 disease? Is it bad? Is it not bad? And how can we design a study to check it out?
Yes. And we're going to need to take a quick break. And let's pick up with that in the next segment. But we are Beyond the Birds and the Bees at Talk Radio 1370. Please feel free to join us at 390-1370. We'll be back in a minute.
Welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Hi, I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn with the Texas Fertility Center, and we're in our second segment of our hour of Beyond the Birds and the Bees. And Dr. Silverberg is joining me by phone. He may not be here quite yet, but he'll join us in just a second. He is was delayed in the office because of our patient load, and we'd commented earlier about women ovulating on weekends, and actually had made a comment that if patients could fix that, that would be fine. Of course, we don't expect that. But on the other hand, patients will be very nice when they come in and say, I am so sorry you have to be here on the weekend. We actually love what we do, so it really doesn't matter. And, you know, after being an obstetrician and delivering babies and being up all night, we still think we're on vacation. So this is not a bad thing at all. Well, whenever we finished our last segment, we were right in the middle of talking about an endometriosis study in Canada. And we talked about that the study was done that we probably could not do in the United States. And let me just explain that. This was a study where women who had had trouble conceiving and basically everything else had been normal underwent a laparoscopy, and some of those women were found to have endometriosis. Those that were mild or minimal were broken into two groups, those treated and half of the people not treated. But the physicians did not tell the patients who was treated, whom were treated. So that's the part that would be very difficult to do. So the patients didn't know if they were treated or not, and after a period, a long period of time, 1 to 2 years, the code was broken to see who became pregnant and who didn't become pregnant. This study is well designed to answer the question, does treating mild or minimal endometriosis increase the chances of conceiving? Well, it turned out that those that had been treated did have a higher pregnancy rate. It answered a very fundamental question, which is very helpful for us. But again, that would be very, very difficult to repeat that study. Also in the last segment, Dr. Silverberg explained what endometriosis is, and it's a disease process. Important to know, it is not a cancer. It does not increase a woman's chance of having cancer. It can act like a cancer. That means it can be very aggressive and grow, can grow into the bowel and the bladder, anything in the pelvic area, pelvic cavity, and can interfere with fertility and not uncommonly cause pelvic pain. And patients have asked, are we seeing more of the disease? And I think we are. And the reason why we're seeing more is probably because women are delaying childbearing. If a woman becomes pregnant early in her life, in her reproductive life, then the chance of developing endometriosis is limited. It is much less than if she delays childbearing. So therefore, if she does delay childbearing, then she may develop this disease, present for infertility, and so we're much more likely to see it. So it's a real common disease, particularly for women in their 30s. We tend not to see it in really young women like teenagers and early 20s, but certainly we do see it at that time. Then the other end of the spectrum, usually when women go through menopause, it regresses, goes away, and the reason for that is because it's being fed by the ovary. So with menopause, menses pause, of course, ovarian function has stopped, and therefore there's no nourishment for the endometriosis, so it goes away. Has Dr. Silverberg joined us yet? Haven't heard from him yet.
Okay. I don't think we hear him wiggling around yet.
Well, he's a busy guy, and so that's certainly understandable.
Yeah, he said he was going to run down the hall and do some insemination.
Well, that's part of what we do every day. Well, you know, something else that I was asked, and we had this question last week, so the person that emailed this to us probably was not listening last week, but it's a very important question, and that is, does insurance tend to cover treatment of infertility? And the answer is that it tends to cover diagnosis of infertility problems, and some insurances do cover treatment, and it's really not necessarily the insurance company. Sounds like I'm defending insurance companies. That's probably the last thing I would do because we struggle with them as much as patients. But it has to do with the employer. In fact, there was a House Bill 843 in the late 80s that required insurance companies to offer to employers coverage for in vitro fertilization. Then it was up to the employer to say, no, we don't want her, we do want it. It's almost like a package. Like those of you that have insurance would understand, you can take out a maternity package, you can take out a dental package. It's something that's added on. So if the employer does not pick it up, then in vitro fertilization itself may not be covered. Now, there's more insurance companies, insurance plans that cover diagnosis and treatment of infertility, but the majority seem to cover diagnosis. And we've talked on previous shows about the diagnostic steps of semen analysis, make sure a woman's ovulating, hysterosalpingograms, if the uterus is normal and the tubes are open, ultrasound, and diagnostic laparoscopy. So it's really common for those to be treated. The second part of her question was, which I think is real important, is, well, is it more likely to be covered if I undergo these tests with my primary care physician, my gynecologist, rather than a true infertility specialist? And the answer is, it doesn't matter. It's really not who's delivering the care or working on the diagnosis. It's really what is being done. For instance, if a woman has a laparoscopy treatment of endometriosis, it doesn't matter who's doing that. It just is the treatment and the treatment code. And there's a very specific code for everything that we do. So the computer in the health plans looks at the code of treatment for endometriosis, and again, it doesn't matter what kind of physician has provided that care. It is either covered or it's not covered. So that's kind of a myth that's always been around. And the best way to determine the answer to these questions are, ask your insurance company directly. Pick up the phone and just call the benefits person and ask very specific questions. Does my insurance cover diagnosis for infertility? Does it cover treatment? And then independent of that, also, does it cover in vitro fertilization? And that way you'll get the most information. I think I hear Dr. Silverberg on the line.
Yep, I'm back.
Okay, you're back. You know, working on Saturdays sometimes can be tough.
Well, it can be. Saturdays, Sundays, holidays. But, you know, I tell people we're here 365 days a year except leap year.
Yep.
When we're here 366.
There you go. And, you know, when you were off the air, I was saying that a couple patients had kind of apologized for getting us out on the weekend to see them. And we just love what we do so much. And I said, after delivering babies for years, I think we're still on vacation.
Oh, yeah. I just love it when patients say, oh, I'm so sorry to have you come in on a Saturday. And I said, well, you know, if it wasn't for those other 32 people we're seeing today, you know, it wouldn't be a problem.
That's right. It is nice, though, that patients are so sensitive to that.
It is. It is. It is. But it just shows their commitment because, you know, it's amazing. I mean, you know, you read everything in the newspapers and in People magazine and all the other magazines about, you know, patients being non-compliant and, you know, doctors will prescribe pills or other types of treatments and patients just don't take them and they don't follow through. Oh, my God, it couldn't be further from the truth in our specialty.
Boy, I tell you what, I was telling our nurses yesterday that one of the main reasons why this practice is so much fun is because patients are so engaged in their care, and it's great that they're women, because the women are more likely to get engaged than the men, but they read about it, they want to know about it, and they follow through. They're really focused, and that helps a lot.
Now, I had two patients today bring me articles from the internet. I mean, two patients today, which is really terrific, and, you know, they've got a lot of questions, but they read, they want to know what's going on, and they want to be in control. I mean, this is part of the problem with fertility treatment and the whole disease process. People feel like they're so out of control. So, you know, we just tell our patients all the time, you know, look, you're the boss here. We're the employees. And, you know, our job as good employees is to go through the world's literature and feed it to you in bite-sized pieces so that you can understand it, because a lot of it's written in medicalese and it's not, you know, regular, you know, mere mortals can't understand it, so to speak. And so we go ahead and we read through it and we figure it out and we present it to them and we offer them choices, and then they're making the choices, but we're involved in helping them make the right choice for them.
Absolutely, and frustration is the key word. Oh, my gosh, you know, most of our patients are, as you had noted, well-educated, well-read, and they've worked hard in life at their jobs and their careers, and usually the harder the work, the more likely they are to succeed, but it's not true with fertility.
Boy, that's for sure.
And I think that makes it very frustrating. And the other part, too, is I think a lot of a lot of us feel like maybe we're not going to be president of the United States or whatever, super successful movie star. But having children is kind of like being born with arms and legs, so to speak, and that almost entitled's not a good word, but sort of entitled. And I think that adds to the frustration of it.
Right. I mean, you know, you've testified before the legislature. I've testified before the legislature. And it's just, it's amazing the level of ignorance that's out there especially when things come up to the legislature about, you know, the donor egg law and the donor sperm law and donor embryos. And, you know, as far as the insurance companies dealing with infertility, people want to classify infertility a lot of times, usually out of ignorance, as some elective condition. And I remember telling people that, you know what, it's not like there's a line that, you know, people walk up to this big counter and there's a line. Do you want to get in the diabetes line, or do you want to get in the heart disease line, or the cancer line, or the infertility line? You don't have a choice. You know, these are cards that you've been dealt a lot of times. And unfortunately, you find yourself in line, and it's your obligation to take care of yourself and try and figure out the best possible treatment for whatever condition you've been given.
Yeah, it's real interesting talking to the people that aren't involved about, well, this is just not a disease process. This is, as you said, elective. This is just sort of a choice that you're making.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. And, you know, and of course, they, particularly the legislature, wanted to compare it to treatment of diabetes and other diseases. And it was interesting when I was testifying that they came at me really with, well, if we cover infertility, do we not cover diabetes? And I'm kind of going, you need to cover both. They're
right.
Both important. Oh, my right. gosh. Why should we sacrifice for that? That may happen with the new health care plan where there's choices of not covering certain things. But now we really should be covering all of the problems.
That's exactly right. And, you know, our patients pay premiums to their insurance companies. You know, if you've got a job, if you're working at Dell or AMD or Apple or wherever you're working, you know, you're paying insurance premiums every single month. Money is being deducted from your paycheck. And the problem is a lot of that money is going to pay for your coworkers' pediatric conditions, so their children who've, you know, got to go to the pediatrician, or if they smoke, you know, their smoking-related illnesses or alcohol-related illnesses or their diabetes or their heart disease, conditions that you probably don't have. And you are entitled to be able to use your insurance money for whatever disease state that you have that you need treatment for.
No question about it. It's so important, and actually it's helpful when patients talk this up, or if they know individuals involved in decision making, from human resource benefits people at their employer all the way to if they know our congressman.
Right, and I can tell you, our congressmen are very, very, very involved in what's going on, and I think we probably should, I don't know how we digress from endometriosis to, you know, congressional testimony, but anyway, we probably ought to get back towards endometriosis or we're going to find ourselves in big trouble.
That's for sure, but we could talk about that for a while, couldn't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, my gosh.
Well, you know, right after the break, I did explain a little bit more about the Endocan study and exactly how it was done, where they didn't tell the patients if they'd been treated or not, and how it actually is a great study for science because it gives us a definitive answer, but something that we probably couldn't do in the States. And, of course, Lisa had an editorial comment last week about it, saying that this is socialized medicine at its best.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it is socialized medicine. But the good news about that study was it was socialized medicine at its best, because in this case, we were able to get some answers, some definitive answers, but it was done in a research setting. And I think that, you know, very few people would object, or far fewer people, I should say, would object to socialized medicine when it's done in a research setting to try and answer specific questions than they would when it's done in an everyday setting of this is the way medicine is.
Well, how true is that? Another part of the question that we had on endometriosis, Kalen, is, I have had trouble conceiving, and you're suggesting laparoscopy. How could I have endometriosis? I don't really have pelvic pain.
Right.
So I have, quote, no symptoms of endometriosis.
Right, and that's one of the most frustrating things about the condition, because, as we all know, the severity of the disease and the severity of the symptoms have no relation to each other. You know, it's not like heart disease. I mean, with heart disease, if you have no disease, you have no symptoms. And as your vessels close down, you get more and more symptomatic. So, you know, you might, you know, in the old days you could run a marathon, and then, you know, you find out that you can walk, but if you walk too far, you start to get a little short of breath. And then you find out, you know, God forbid, getting up out of a chair, you're really short of breath. And, you know, what's happening is those vessels are closing down, so the more severe the disease, the more severe the symptoms. But with endometriosis, it just isn't the same way.
Well, and also I think what's important is, although patients relate pain to endometriosis, we relate fertility to endometriosis. So if all the tests have been normal and we look, studies have shown that up to 40, 45% of women will have something wrong, something we can fix probably,
right,
when we look.
Right.
And in fact, even if it's only 40 to 50% positive, what we find, I would say 95% of it we can take care of with the laparoscope.
Oh, yeah, almost always. Almost always. And then, you know, fortunately, there are good medications that, you know, what if we get in there and we find horrible stage 4 disease and, you know, we resect the masses of endometriosis from the ovaries and we can reconstruct the ovaries surgically, and we do it through these little bitty incisions. So, you know, patients typically would have surgery on a Thursday or Friday, go back to work on a Monday. It's just easy. You know, they're not going to run a marathon on Monday, but on the other hand, they'll really be in good shape. And we can do tremendous amounts of surgery and huge operations through little bitty incisions, and they're home in time for lunch, which is really just phenomenal. It just still amazes me but that the technology is so great. But what if we get in there and there's bad disease, and we resect most of the bad disease, but then there's some lesions on the bowel, or there are lesions that are right near the ureters, which are the tubes that carry urine from the kidneys to the bladder? Well, certainly we don't want to resect those because we're going to potentially compromise the patient's long-term health. But we have options.
We have a lot of options. I mean, this patient could be treated medically. This patient, if her primary goal is to become pregnant and not just pelvic pain control, then, of course, there's always options of in vitro fertilization also.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we've got some great medicines. I mean, Lupron's a great medicine that we can use. I know a lot of patients are afraid of it because they read stuff about it on the Internet, but we have hundreds of patients on Lupron at any given time, and the incidence of side effects that are problematic is so low. And oh my gosh, all the patients who we've treated who come in and, you know, they're just essentially disabled. You know, when they have periods, they're out of work for long periods of time. Intercourse sometimes is just absolutely impossible because it's so painful. And then they get treated, and they're totally different human beings. You know, they say they can do everything that they used to be able to do. They just didn't realize how bad they were feeling because they had forgotten what it felt like to feel normal.
That's for sure. Oh, my gosh. You know, that's one of the first things I learned in gynecology. I'm so glad I'm a guy.
Yeah.
Well, we're coming right up against a break, and so we are going to take a break. We are Talk Radio 1370. Don't hesitate to join us, 390-1370. We'll be back in a minute.
Welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Hello again. I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn with the Texas Fertility Center, and I'm joined by my partner, Dr. Kaylin Silverberg, who's in the office. Kaylin, are you there?
I am.
Well, great. I just wanted to ask, since you've had to see patients in between these breaks and everything, did anyone say that they had to wait a little bit? And you said, it's no big deal. I'm on the radio.
No, everybody's very understanding. Oh, my gosh. Our patients are so supportive of what we do, and it's terrific. It's really terrific. And, in fact, I told one of the patients asked me, so what are you guys talking about today? And so we're talking about endometriosis. And she said, well, can you guys kind of figure out a way to destroy endometriosis so we don't have to suffer from it anymore? I mean, it's just a horrible problem.
It really is. Wouldn't it be nice to have a vaccination?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, any kind of polio or something like that.
Yeah, or the flu, something that you can just get a shot and you never get it.
Right. At the end of the last segment, we were talking a little bit about medical treatment for endometriosis. And actually, we're talking about it in combination with surgical treatment. And it kind of dovetails into what I'd said earlier, and that is that endometriosis tends to go away in menopause. And that's when the ovary is not able to work anymore and feed endometriosis. Well, this medication that Kaylin talked about, Lupron, puts the ovary to sleep by way of the pituitary gland, but puts it to sleep, so therefore it can't feed the endometriosis. Therefore, it helps treat endometriosis that is present.
That's exactly right. And, you know, it's kind of funny because all of the medical treatments for endometriosis were designed based on normal conditions that happen and the observations that, people observe. So, for example, you know, one regimen to treat endometriosis was the birth control pill. And the reason people thought of birth control pills is because we know that endometriosis regresses during pregnancy. And during pregnancy, estrogen levels are real high and progesterone levels are real high. And so, therefore, people thought, well, gee, what kind of medicines do we have that have high estrogen and high progesterone? And the answer was, well, wait, it's obvious. How about a birth control pill? So investigators, you know, 30, 40 years ago started using birth control pills for endometriosis. And it met with limited success because, you know, in a lot of patients, if you put them on birth control pills, their symptoms will get a little bit better for a period of time. The problem is that birth control pills don't kill the endometriosis. And so, unfortunately, the disease continues to progress, and we're kind of putting a Band-Aid on it. We've just kind of masked the symptoms.
That's exactly right. You know, the birth control pills in those days was referred to as a pseudo-pregnancy because the women were given high doses of birth control pills continuously. They didn't have a break. They didn't have a period. Again, just as Kaylin said, mimicking a pregnancy. So it was actually for 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
Another one, it turned out that there was an observation on the East Coast at some program, it may have been Hopkins, that when a woman was given androgen, testosterone, that her discomfort improved. Maybe
right.
Not the disease, but her discomfort improved. And so a drug came along in the 80s called Danazol or Danacrin. And I don't know if anyone's read about that, but the concept there was to try to treat it and suppress it. And it really just didn't work very well.
Yeah, no, it was just the horrible side effects. I mean, oh my gosh, the side effects were god-awful, and patients hated it. And even though it would work for pain, that led investigators to continue to look and search for other alternatives. And that's when Depo-Lupron was really discovered, and they came up with that. And that's really the mainstay of medical treatment these days, because we know that unlike the other drugs that maybe can suppress the symptoms, Depo-Lupron can knock out and kill the disease, because what it does is it blocks the production of estrogen from the ovary. And we know that estrogen is the fuel that makes the endometriosis fire burn. So estrogen is like the oxygen for the fire. And if you suck out the oxygen, the fire burns out. If you suck out the estrogen, the fire burns out. The endometriosis can tend to go away. The problem is, in a way, kind of like cancer, it never really goes away completely. So those cells are kind of hanging around, and as women continue to have periods, those cells can get regenerated and the disease can come back. And so, you know, we know, I tell my patients all the time, please just don't do nothing for this disease, because we've all read this book and we know how it ends. It ends, unfortunately, usually with patients on the operating room table and a doctor's getting ready to take their uterus out. And it's so preventable, because by treating patients either laparoscopically with minimally invasive surgery to get rid of the disease, or by putting them on medication, or even better, by helping them get pregnant, then we can go ahead usually and treat the disease in such a way that it may never come back.
That's exactly right. And that's why we need to be aggressive with this. And patients, even when they're not attempting pregnancy, if they have an unusual amount of pelvic pain, it's reasonable to consult their gynecologist and see if this is what's going on, because it's always better to treat early.
Correct.
Prevention's always the best treatment.
No, I know it. And we've got patients who come in. I mean, you know, we've got some 13-year-olds in the practice, and I've got a 15-year-old I'm taking care of right now. And it's just, you know, it's a horrible condition, because in the old days, you know, women would have horrible cramping with their period. Nobody would do anything about it, because there really weren't any tools that we had at our disposal to do anything with. And unfortunately, these young women would suffer not in silence. I mean, I'm sure that they'd go home and close the door and scream their heads off, but because it's just a horrible problem. But unfortunately, there wasn't anything really that could be done. And now there's so many things that can be done, so many non-surgical things that can be done as well. And we've really got good options for treatment for women for all ages.
And I think that as we had talked earlier about delay in childbearing increasing the risk of endometriosis and infertility, that if we have a patient who wasn't necessarily interested in becoming pregnant, but let's say she's married and kind of still in that first few years of honeymoon of marriage and has a disease, we would then encourage them to get pregnant earlier in their marriage.
Absolutely, because like we were saying over and over again, the best treatment for endometriosis is pregnancy. It's better than medicine. It's better than surgery. It's really better than anything. And it's so effective, and so many times when patients get pregnant, their disease may never come back.
Yeah, that's very helpful. You know, we talked about the Lupron and how it will take away a woman's menstrual period. Well, unfortunately, they really should not be on Lupron for a real extended period of time for several years unless we add hormones back. You
right.
talk a little bit about the what happens when there are no hormones over a period of 6 months.
Yeah, well, the problem is that one, I mean, yeah, there's so many differences, obviously. I mean, I don't want Jessica to start laughing at me, but there's so many differences between men and women. And, you know, one of the major differences is that women make estrogen, and estrogen provides women with a lot of protection. So, for example, one of the reasons that women don't get heart disease as early in life as men do is because of estrogen. One of the reasons that women, unfortunately, can get a condition called osteoporosis, unlike men, is if they lose their estrogen. And so, remember, with Depo-Lupron, what's happening is the medicine is blocking the production of estrogen from the ovary. And so what happens is, in the absence of ovarian estrogen production, women can get osteoporosis. And what happens there is that the bone mineral density, the density of the calcium and the minerals that are in the bone itself, decreases. So the bones get thinner. And then if you trip and you fall, you're much more likely to have a problem. You can break your hip, which is a horrible problem. Women sometimes, I don't know if some of our listeners can think back to their grandparents or even their great-grandparents, especially their grandmothers or great-grandmothers, they would remember that maybe over time they complained that they were getting shorter, or maybe over time their backs started to curve a little bit, so their chins kind of started to jut out a little bit more, and they couldn't really stand up straight anymore. Well, all of those things are due to fractures or compression fractures of the spine. And so we know that as women lose bone mineral density, the two worst areas that are affected appear to be the spine and the hips.
Yes, and you, by the way, Jessica is kind of surprised that with all your education, you had to go to medical school to know there's a difference between men and women.
Yeah, well, there's lots of differences. I just didn't want her to laugh at me about that.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're too late. She's just been laughing all morning at you. But yeah, that is a problem. So if a woman has no estrogen production over a period of 6 months, then we have this risk of osteopenia, would be demineralization of the bones. But talk a little bit while we're on the subject about add back.
Well, you know, some people came up probably about 12 or 15 years ago now with the concept that what if, you know, when we give Depo-Lupron, it takes away the hormones, right? It just takes away the estrogen. It takes away the progesterone. Those levels just sink to rock bottom levels. And what if maybe we give a little bit of it back at a time? So there was a big study that was performed at Harvard. That was the main center for the study. And they had four treatment arms. In one treatment arm, they gave patients Lupron and sugar pills for estrogen and sugar pills for progesterone, so placebo. The second arm, they gave patients Lupron plus low-dose estrogen and low-dose progesterone. In the third arm, they gave high-dose estrogen and low-dose progesterone. And in the fourth arm, they gave low-dose progesterone only. So I'm sure I've confused everybody thoroughly, unless you got a pencil and a piece of paper and you're tracking all this out. But the bottom line is that they followed these patients, and they measured bone mineral density, they measured chemistry levels, they measured all kinds of things, lipid levels. And what they found was that patients who got Lupron only, with no estrogen and no progesterone supplementation, they dropped out of the study because they were miserable. They were having horrible hot flashes, vaginal dryness. They were just miserable. And when they did their radiology studies, they found that they lost about 6% of their bone. So then they looked at the other group of patients that dropped out, and that was the group of patients who got high-dose estrogen and some progesterone. And those patients dropped out because their endometriosis symptoms came back. So, you know, it's like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. You know, we know the soup is too hot, and we know the soup is too cold, and so what we got to do is find the soup that's just right. And the soup that was just right were the two groups in the middle. And that was the group that got only progesterone, or the group that got progesterone with a little bit of estrogen added back. And those patients did well because their endometriosis symptoms stayed gone. They had no symptoms from the Lupron, so no hot flashes, no vaginal dryness. When they followed their chemistry levels stayed in the normal range, their lipid levels or fat levels stayed in the normal range, and their bone mineral density stayed in the normal range. And so, therefore, the recommendation these days is that if you're going to go on Lupron for any period of time, you know, in the old days it was a year, then it was 6 months, now for any period of time, you should probably start taking at least low-dose progesterone as an add-back every day. And if that doesn't work, you're still having symptoms from, you know, from the Lupron, then maybe ask your doctor to give you a little bit of low-dose estrogen in addition, and that'll certainly block the hot flashes, block the vaginal dryness. You won't be getting enough medicine to have your symptoms come back, but you'll certainly feel profoundly better, and you won't have those side effects.
This was really helpful to have medical therapy for those women who are not ready to become pregnant. Either they don't have a partner or whatever reason, it's just not the right time, who are really crippled with this discomfort from this disease and can be maintained medically for an extended period of time.
Right.
Well, Kaylin, we're coming up against the end of the hour, and we are Dr. Silverberg and Vaughn with the Texas Fertility Center for Beyond the Birds and the Bees at Talk Radio 1370. Don't forget that we have great resources at our website, txfertility.com. And I hope you have a good afternoon, and we'll see you on the radio next Saturday at noon.